Reverend daughter, Lieutenant Dias, united we stand, divided we fall, or so the saying goes.
I don't know how much I can do, confessed Dulcie, who was most likely Duchess Septimus, and who had wrinkled her nose when a fat drop of rain had fallen on it. The gleaming Protesilaus thrust the umbrella over her head.
I didn't really prove myself. There was nothing much to prove on Rhodes. When I came here, I thought it might be my chance to do something.
She finished this rather helpless little speech by playing with a fold on her virginal white skirts. Harrowhark said bluntly,
Listen to your first instinct. There's a tube in your chest and you can barely walk.
I felt heaps better since I got here, Dulcie said defensively. I've coughed a few times, but it's mainly for show, isn't it, Pro?
Do not mistake the thaw for the spring. Our buds is not yet certain, quoth her cavalier.
Harrowhark deliberately did not watch for the hot flash of murder in her own cavalier's eyes, though it at least leavened his thick, porridgey sadness. It must have been traumatic to see his only cultivated personality trait co-opted by someone who looked like the hero of his very own epics. It was more interesting to look at Abigail Pent, to look at those slender, workaday hands turning over the forearms and elbows of the body that was, apparently, Palamedes Sextus, examining.
No defense wounds, Pent murmured. Just like Judith. I wonder.
The wind had picked up. It suddenly screamed shrilly over the glass-covered, vine-choked roof, bringing bullet sprays of hard rain in its wake. For a moment, Abigail shuddered. Then she straightened up and clapped her hands together, as though she led a class of unruly small children.
"We're all in this together," she said, which was a typically fifth assumption.
The ninth didn't think anyone was in anything together, or if they were, they all had to disperse as soon as humanly possible to avoid splash damage.
I am beginning to suspect I know where the danger lies, or at least I've got a perfectly baseless assumption, and every scholar knows that this is where you begin. Dulcie, Lady Dulcinea, do you mind if I ask you to get Silas Octokaiser on with us? He's neither to hold nor to bind to me, but he might listen to you.
Fine,
said the woman in the chair, drying her nose carefully with her crochet necktie, so as not to disturb her shunt.
I don't love you for asking, but I won't say that the renowned Abigail Pent asked something of me and I didn't do it, and you've been kind to Cam and Pal.
I'll go.
Abigail said, Magnus, will you ask the lieutenant?
Anything for you, even that, he said promptly.
And, Reverend Daughter, if you can, when you can, Coronabeth Tridentarius, and her sister, of course, she added, though Harrowhark thought that addition a bit belated. With the Cavalier, again, if you can.
I haven't been able to check.
I'll get any leftovers. Ask everyone to leave the facility alone, to come together, and find out whose room doesn't leak, she added, struck by inspiration. So we can put down mattresses, as I tell you for free, we're flooded.
It was left to the cavaliers to transfer the faceless body of Camilla Hecht back into the frozen morgue. Abigail had removed all of the cavaliers' effects from her pockets and was brooding over them like a crossword, and the intubated flesh necromancer wheeled herself over to the grisly remains of the skinny sixth boy. He was a perfectly normal sight, except from the neck up.
"Is this how it happens, Lady Pent?" she asked soberly.
Abigail picked up a worn leather strap that must have belonged to a clockwork watch face and said gently,
"No, it's not." "Does it get better than this, do you know?"
This did not seem to Harrow like a question that could ever be answered. She did not fully understand it, but the seventh did love questions that were as beautiful as they were unanswerable.
This oblique sally did not get a response from the other woman, who had taken off her glasses to examine a criss-crossed piece of wax and a fragment of darning thread. Harrow Hark felt bounden to look at the things they had taken from the Master Warden's pockets. A scrap of soft cloth that you might wipe your glasses with, a pen, a little fold-out examining lens, a crumpled-up piece of flimsy. When the cavaliers came to bear away the warden, less heavy than his cavalier, only Magnus and the seventh, Protesilaus, bore him, with Ortus hovering on the sidelines, the chair-bound girl gave a woeful little sigh.
"Oh, goodbye," she called out suddenly to the corpse borne aloft. "Goodbye, Palamedes, my first strand. Goodbye, Camilla, my second. One cord was overpowered. Two cords could defend themselves, but three were not broken by the living or the dead."
Harrow Hark suddenly felt something in her core, though she did not know precisely what it was. Somehow, in Canaan House, her ability to feel had been blunted, leaving only a sense of dislocated longing, a bizarre yearning as though flipping through the pages of a book for a proverb she remembered but could not find. She focused on what was in her hands, instead of on a stranger's farewell to strangers. The piece of flimsy was rolled up so tightly that it resembled a kind of fat pill. She took off her gloves, and with the edges of her fingernails, bitten to the quick and never much help, she started to prise open one wrinkled corner. She was thoroughly surprised when a deep shadow fell over her, when her cavalier primary laid one black-gloved hand down on her naked ones.
"My Lady Harrow Hark," whispered Ortus, "perhaps, maybe you shouldn't, in case."
"You presume overmuch," she snapped.
He withdrew.
"I have often thought so," he said sadly.
By the time she swept into the corridor, the rain driving through the holes in the roof and the walls and lashing in with gusty, bad-smelling sprays, Ortus three-quarters of a step behind her, she had nearly gotten the whole thing open. She opened it, hummocked and humped all over with little rills from being overfolded, and she read, "Him I'll kill quick, because she asked me to, and because that much he honestly deserves, but you two mummified wizard shits I will burn and burn and burn and burn until there is no trace of you left in the shadow of my long-lost natal son."
"It is a drawing of the letter S,"
said the deep, solemn voice from over her shoulder, and she realized she had stopped mid-stride.
"The letter in question is constructed from 6 short marks stacked vertically 3 by 3. There are 2 triangles on the top and bottom, which, along with some diagonal strokes, form a calligraphic S."
"Nigonad," said Harrow, without turning, "I did not ask you."
3 people are dead, my Lady Harrow Hark," said her cavalier. 1 ranked cohort necromancer, 2 scions of the enigmatic 6th house, quick in learning and wisdom, if not in martial prowess. Am I to act only on your command when the sleeper comes for me?"
"Were you planning to do anything other than lie down and die?" she said, waiting for rage, dying for rage, hoping for the simulacrum of rage, if nothing else. "What do you think you can do, Ortus? Did you have a tactic beyond stopping bullets with your body?"
"It would be within the family character, I agree," said Ortus meditatively. "My father died simply because your mother and father asked him to. He took his own life when your parents handed him the rope, though he had a wife at home and, if he acknowledged it, a son."
Harrow lowered the flimsy, more out of instinct than intent. She found herself turning around to look Ortus full in the face, as best she could with the umbrella over his head, and the hood half-plastered to his scalp with rain, despite the oilcloth's best efforts, and his painted skull now a sad melange of alabaster grey and black. She looked at his underslept, roly-poly face, his deep black, drear-burr eyes. They were not true black, as she had usually thought. In the shadow, she could finally see a deep, earthy undertone, like the ploughed-up additive ground in the planter fields. His grown-up features were suddenly ancient to her. She wanted to panic, to feel the icy knives of despair.
"You knew," she said. "You knew the whole time that Mortis the Ninth died at their command."
Now Ortis's face changed. It slid a second time into paint-splattered, black-irised, hooded contempt. He looked at her as though she were tedious. He looked at her as though he did not know who she was. His contempt made the doors she heard in her ears slam in an orchestra of unfathomable sound. He looked at her as though she were a squalling infant, as though she had not spoken, but rather opened her mouth and vomited.
"Harrow," he said curtly, "you are not the only person who can add up 2 and 2 and arrive at 4.
Any reply she might have made was aborted by a sudden gust of rain through a broken window. A curtain of murky water splattered through the glass moor. The water carried with it a handful of flashing brown and steel objects, which fell in a tumbled heap on the rotten Canaan House corridor carpet. When they came to rest, she and Ortis stared down at a collection of large, rusted pipette needles, the hard plex type, with measurement markings up the side.
"Would you like to know if I can see them also?"
Ortis asked humbly, after a long, rain-swept pause. Chapter 22. The night after you killed your 13th planet, you were beset by a dream wherein you sat down to dinner opposite the body. This was far better than the normal travails of dinner, with its partakers all wearing the filmy mother-of-pearl Canaanite robes that clung to Mercy Morn like starlight, turned Augustine ethereal, gave Ianthe jaundice, and rendered you a sacrificial parsnip. That trial where, if you did not eat enough, the Emperor of the Nine Houses told you kindly, "Try just a few more spoonfuls, Harrowhark," as Ianthe repressed not her smirks. But in the dream, you wore your thick, dark vestments of the Ninth House, and sat only opposite the monstrous dead of the locked tomb, who wore the shabby black shirt and trousers of some particularly slovenly penitent. Both of you wore the sacramental skull paint, and you talked comfortably of very little. Yet it felt as though it meant very much, and nobody made you eat. Then the body looked at you with those direct, incalculable eyes, and she said, "Harrowhark, wake up."
"Pardon?"
"Wake up. Now."
You opened your eyes to the ceiling the long-lost Anastasia had never seen, twisted in the bedclothes she had never slept in. The thickly insulated blackout hangings covering the plex windows projected the high ceilings into an eternity of shadows, and you could barely perceive your hands in front of your face. You pushed away the coverlet. You were cold beneath your nightgown, which had been short in the leg when you went away to Canaan House, and was a sorry affair now, and your exoskeleton scraped quite loudly in that black silence as you took the bone-sheathed sword from its lover-like position next to you on the bed. You held it with the swaddled blade flat on your shoulder, your hands cupping the bottom of the hilt, still the pommel, and you did not strap on the rapier that the Emperor had given you. It was lighter outside your rooms, in the corridor. The low yellow panel lights cast warped skeletal shadows up and down the memorials of the Mithraeum. They had been turned down to faint blue-hued ambers to acknowledge the hours of sleep, and gave texture more than vision. To your drear-burr eyes, however, the passageway was flooded with light. That was why you saw her so clearly.
She stood at the curve of the passage, perhaps 15 meters from you. She struck weird shadows in that low halo of cold yellow, the softly gleaming whites of her shift glowing like a shaft of light through green water. There were still smudges of petal in her pale brown curls, and her eyes were too dark to see, but you recalled their nightmarish blueness. Kitheraya looked at you, turned toward you, and began to walk. That walk, that shuffling, disconcerting, slithering walk. The body flung its arms before it for momentum, the legs stiff-thighed and lock-kneed, right side arm moving in time with right side leg. Ridiculous. Appalling. Those fixed dead fingers caught a skeletal arm wrapped in gold foil, amethysts studded like so many eyes between the knuckle bones, and it clattered to the ground, and Kitheraya tripped over it, without the head losing its tracking focus on you. Those unblinking eyes adhered to yours, and the body splayed and juddered on the ground. Then the corpse began moving inchworm fashion, pushed forward by the action of the legs, the forearms banging on the tiles, thrusting the blessed bones of some fallen faithful out the way as though unnoticed. It was as though a magnet was stuck in the meat, a magnet that craved some polar force within you. This assemblage writhed closer. You were a holy lictor. Harrowhark the First, 9th necro-saint to the King Undying, heir to a hard-won power that burnt in you like fusion. It was not arrogance to name yourself one of the most powerful necromancers in the universe. You took one look at that relentless, freakish argument of limbs, and you fled. You hurled yourself back inside your room and locked the door. You scrabbled inside your mouth, drew blood with your fingernails, bit your tongue, swabbed your reddened saliva on the door in the hasty whirls of a blood ward, and pushed a chair up and beneath the handle mindlessly. You threw yourself to the ground, your heart rattling the bars of its ribcage prison. There was nothing but silence. Your body was the greatest source of noise. Your chattering breath, your noisily pumping blood, your mashing teeth. Everything else was profoundly dark and still. And then, from the door, the warded door that should have burst its theorems outward upon even the touch of foreign magic, from the door there came the soft scraping noise of someone dragging nails down steel. The handle eased downward in its latch and hit the chair. And stopped. Great, greasy silence. Then another desperate rattle. And then, nothing. How long you lay on the cool, glassy tiles, forehead pressed into a red welter against clear obsidian glass, one of your fists bunched in the rough, knotted fretwork of the rug you did not know. You could only mark the passing of time when the habitation settings kicked into action, and the panels around the room diffused pre-waking light, intended to mimic a circadian sunrise. You were cold all over, shivering in your exoskeleton until the bone cuticles rattled into your skin. At some point you stood, mechanically, and you went and lay back down in bed. There was nothing else you could do. It seemed unlikely that you slept. When you thought it was late enough, in the notional morning, you put on your mother-of-pearl robe and you rapped on Ianthe's door. It was not late enough. She answered after a long, scuffling minute, with sleep in her eyes and her hair in dilute whey-tangles over her neck and shoulders, wearing a bewildering short garment of violet chiffon. You said instantly, "Septimus is walking." It took a moment for her to understand the name that had never been Kitheraya's. After long seconds, recognition flashed in those adulterated blue eyes. You saw understanding replace the grouchy morning crossness. You saw it fade before an overwhelming boredom, and you knew that Ianthe would not help you. Tell her I want my arm back, she said, and slammed the door in your face.
Act 3. Chapter 23. 4 months before the Emperor's murder. You were aware, as a hand thrust into cold water might not notice until too late that the water had begun to boil, that an atmosphere of greater unease had settled over the Mithraeum. It would have taken an absolute straight-up idiot not to notice, though. When you were all called to the interminable dinners for which Augustine hinted you should dress, which you took to mean that you should wear your mother-of-pearl robe by way of ritual, and which Ianthe took to mean that she should wear things beneath hers that were not worth looking at, and pin her mass of pale hair on top of her head, and which meant that God never came in a shirt that didn't badly want a new collar, it became brutally obvious. The lictors now ate all their dinners staring at tablets. Sometimes Mercy Morn spread open a system map of local space, triangulating things that the elders frowned over and talked about in a way that did not include you or Ianthe. Quite often, you two ate dinner in stony silence while, as Ianthe bitterly put it, the adults talked. You began to find Augustine alone in the training room. He did nothing so pedestrian and comforting as training, but stared, paced, thought about reaching for his rapier, then abandoned the idea and left. Augustine had been in training for the past 10,000 years. You did not know what his idea of training looked like. Or often you found Ianthe with him, going through motions with an unresponsive, fat-fingered ham-handedness that was not in keeping with her poise. She always wore an expression of exquisite, hardened surrender on her face, as though to say, "You do realize I'm not going to do this." You only ventured in there yourself, far too late into sleeping hours for anyone else to be up. Then you would strip down to your shirt and exoskeleton, and your trousers and your bare feet, and you would hold the two-handed sword in front of you, and lift it up, and point it down, and do a long and unutterably dull series of minute movements, trying to feel normal, trying to understand. You tried hard, in a way that would have broken the heart of any actual swordswoman. If your arms responded more ably now, if you were able to lift and slowly strike, then it would not save your life at the hands of a herald, a thing that none of your teachers had yet managed to describe. "Imagine," said Augustine meditatively, when you asked, "imagine the worst bee, but with a blood aspect, if you knew the whole time that it was a multitude of bloods. I'm talking at least 3 different types of blood here."
"The last time I fought one, I did it with my eyes closed," said Mercy Morn in her turn, and finished as though her punchline was a triumph. "When I opened them, they had bled anyway."
"Do you know, I have rarely seen the heralds," said God, when you finally came to question him. "Whenever they come, I am bundled off to a sealed sanctum at the heart of the Mithraeum, so that their insanity can't touch me. Despite all that soundproofing, I hear them. I always hear them."
You said, "Lord, teacher." "The Saint of Joy will be active when we are all in the river," you said. "And the Saint of Duty, and the Saint of Patience, and Ianthe. 4 lictors, fighting with their cavaliers' perfect sword hands. Teacher, is it so sure a thing that I am going to die? I will be dormant, I know, but are they not enough to protect our bodies as we destroy the brain?"
"Ianthe is far from a perfect sword hand."
You did not know why you defended her. "She will perform on the day, teacher. It's a pose."
"We cannot afford to pose," he said, but there was a faint smile at his weary mouth. "Ianthe the First is a continual surprise to me.
If I was going to pass out a fourth epithet, I'd call her the Saint of Awe.
You thought that had not quite suited Nibirius, though it was hard to remember the Prince of Ida these days. He was a face and a set of eyes and very little else. It was as though your brain had formed a scab over everything that had happened to you. But you pressed.
Lord, it's not certain that I'm going to die.
He did not correct your lord then. In those oil-slick, inconceivable eyes, you saw a flicker of something you did not understand. God said,
Harrowhark, to that, to everything, all I can say is that I live in hope, and that you need to keep handling your rapier.
So you kept handling your rapier. It was on one of these late nights, coming back to your room with a heavy heart and bare feet, running with sweat, arms screaming in the wrong places, your fingers red and raw beneath their coats of cartilage, that you came to the flesh pillar atrium before the habitation ring, and noticed that the auto door to Kithareia's tomb was shut. It was never shut. Its wounded openness, the thin smell of perpetual roses that always seemed to drift from that terrible monument, was a constant. Now it was closed. You stood before that door, hearing the quiet injunction of your emperor to, maybe not. In a very real way, he was correct. You did not understand your fears enough to confront them. You did not even understand if they were real. Back when you were a child, and hung up on something you thought you had seen or heard, Crux would say,
"You saw what you saw, lady. And the only thing you control now is your reaction thereto."
You had seen the corpse walking. Now you would react. The steel of the door was very close to your face, and misted up with your breath. With one swift movement, you pushed it open. What confronted you was Autus the First, his back bare to you, in a pair of soft flannel sleeping trousers and nothing else, so that you could see the protruding, tumorous knobbles of his spine and the wads of muscle atop his shoulders. Kithareia's limp corpse was propped upright, her fingers dangling over his forearm, the dead dove whiteness of her face half covered by his own, rosebuds crushed to deep yellow shadows at his feet. His palm supported the exhausted lily stem of her neck. The press of his fingers on that faded skin was so gentle that it left no mark. You, who had been so familiar with his hands in all their violent attitudes, had not thought them capable of that kind of gentleness. It made them seem alien from the rest of the man. And he was... Crimson heat scoured your neck all the way up to your ears. The lictor, who so often tried to kill you, did not turn around, though you had, in a split second, already thickened your exoskeleton to double density and slapped big layers of enamel over your heart. Autus stiffened to the point that his shoulder blades showed real danger of bursting through his back. He had become one enormous hunch. You were frozen in a welter of adrenaline confusion, ready only for his inevitable murderous blow. You were not ready for the un-Autus-like tenor of his voice when he said calmly, back so vulnerably offered to you,
"Close the door and go away."
You closed the door. You went away.
"I caught the Saint of Duty in the throes of grave lust," you told Ianthe about a minute later.
She was not asleep either, but sitting up in bed with the lamp on, making complicated notes in a little journal.
"Oh my God," said the Princess of Ida. She looked enchanted.
In the lamplight, the bags beneath her eyes were very pronounced. Two apple cores sat in a perpetual state of perfumed rot by her bedside. Her attempts to halt decay had progressed admirably. The classical vice. Oldest sin in the book.
All flesh magicians, you said coolly, should be drowned in boiling blood.
Don't tell me the ninth never.
We do not.
Oh, but my beautiful naive.
No.
Never mind that. Was he actually? Here she made an evil gesture with her hands, which she took a moment to comprehend. You know, waxing necrolagnic, committing the love that cannot speak its name. You told her what you had seen, and she was immediately dismissive and mildly crestfallen.
Oh, but who hasn't done that? Said Ianthe.
She reopened her small journal. You noted that whatever she was doing involved some quite substantial mathematics.
Dull. You obviously walked in too early. At least now you know who's been moving her, so to speak.
She did contentious things with her eyebrows, and then, apparently no longer interested, turned back to her mathematics.
Good night, Harrowhark.
You were not to be so lightly disregarded. You stood with your sweat cooling inside your shirt and your flesh adhering to the exoskeleton and said,
The depredations of a bad man do not cause Kithareia to walk.
Ianthe closed her notepad and rested her pale head briefly against the headboard. Bad man, she murmured to herself, and then, I'd walk out on a date with the saint of duty.
Nona Jessimus, this is no time to interrupt grown lictors committing acts that probably seem perfectly normal after 10,000 years with such limited romantic options. Though you should hear some of the things Augustine has told me. My God! Nor is it a good time to advertise that you are not merely a failure, but a mad failure.
You should not advertise your utter lack of imagination, you said. Tridentarius, my position is not so precarious that I am going to ignore things that happen in front of my face.
Yes, but are they, actually?
Don't presume you know what you're talking about.
Your position is that precarious, my dear, said Ianthe, and reached over with a long left arm to place her journal on the rightmost table.
Did you know that Teacher asked Mercy Morn if they could store you in his chamber when we go after the beast? Mercy Morn said no. They decompressed that chamber for a reason, unless he thought it would be nice to asphyxiate you personally.
You said, And did you know that Teacher himself thinks you far from a perfect swordhand?
At her expression, you added,
I personally loathe tattletales for the purpose of insult, but it seems to be your main weapon in our conversations.
Ianthe's mouth had thinned to a purple slit where, you noticed, the skin was torn.
Those were his exact words.
It's no secret that I'm going to die, you said.
In no way were you resigned to that. You had never died before.
I am most likely lashing out. Nevertheless, those were his exact words.
She stared off into the distance, her eyes fixed on the huge painting of the long-dead, clothing-optional lictor.
God is a dickhead, she murmured.
You were astonished by the force of your immediate anger. You were amazed by its intensity. You drew your two-handed sword from your back. Your wrists weren't quite in the right position, but it was a good attempt. The sword's matte, calcified surface sucked in the lamplight, casting strange shadows on her eiderdown. You said,
Do not blaspheme in front of me.
Don't draw on me with that ridiculous thing. You don't even know where you got it.
God gave it to me.
And you've never asked yourself why? At those mere 6 words, your brain revolted. You felt a hot, thick sensation in the back of your top sinuses that you had not felt in a very long time, never approaching your limits enough for it to occur. A nosebleed.
So tell me why, you said evenly.
Can't, she snapped, You ensorcelled my jaw, you fucking psycho shadow vestal. Yes, I worked that one out. So unless I want to do homebrew mandible surgery, I can't squeal to anyone. And I have thought about homebrew mandible surgery, but I have no idea how far back your curse extends, because I'm not a blackened, tedious little bone witch. Now sheathe your sword. You don't want to go toe to toe with me. You said,
there, you are fundamentally wrong.
I'd strangle you with your own visceral fat before you raised one shitty skeleton.
Try me, you said. Oh, try me, Ianthe.
You stared at each other. You at the foot of her bed, sword as still as you could make it, its weight a comforting and familiar pain. Her sitting up in the fallen bedclothes, eyes like ice and frozen ground. You knew how you would do it. She was still fool enough to keep two jeweled candlesticks by her bed, thick with topaz and delicate flecks of polished tassel, and from these you would smash two ropes of Petrus bone straight into either side of her skull. You might run your finger up the inside of your sword blade, curling bone matter from there as though it were butter, fed and strengthened with your own heart's blood. You might scatter it and thrust squamous pegs of thick phalange through her palms, the fissures between her tibiae and fibulae. At that point, you'd get on top of her, use everything you had ever learned from watching Mercy Morn the First, and fuse her spine like a hangman's rope. Ianthe looked at you, and in the paleness of her skin and in the shadows of her lips was her death and yours. Then she rolled over and covered her head with her satin pillow. "Go ahead. Kill me," she said, muffled through a thick layer of down and pillowcase. "I have to train with Augustine in less than 5 hours anyway, and I stayed up too late. Death is preferable." There was no answer to that, naturally, except to sheathe your sword, return to your bedroom, and put yourself to bed defeated. Chapter 24. It was no secret to you, or to anybody in the claustrophobic, smothering schoolroom that was the Mithraeum, that Ianthe's sword-fighting training was at the end of the line. The Saint of Patience had none left for her. Her ineptitude would have been a negligible problem had it not continued when Ianthe was in the river, had her doubts not gummed up the mechanism of Nibirius Turn's mindless sword arm. You had watched the submerged Ianthe's strong, upright, boyish posture flounder as the right arm dropped the sword. A psychological block, certainly, but one projected into the dead soul that stood to defend her body when the mind went voyaging. There was more pressure on her than on you. The eyes that fell on you were now less critical, because in those eyes you were a woman already dead. Your 18th birthday passed without anyone noticing, even you. One night before you went to sleep, you thought to yourself, restlessly, "Another year." You recalled it as you always did, the memorial to the 200 who had died seizing, kicking and choking as their neurotransmitters were poisoned into overdrive. You silently begged them to stay their hands, as you always did. You never asked for forgiveness. Then you slept. Most people would have iced a cake or something. It was soon after your 17th year passed that you acknowledged a truth you had known for some time. Autus the First had to die. His 9th house name no longer bothered you, now that you knew about Anastasia. It seemed reasonable that the foundress responsible for establishing many of your house's naming conventions had chosen to honour her fellow lictors in the days before their names were veiled in holy secrecy. It was just a banal and uncomfortable coincidence, as though he'd carried the name of a dead childhood pet. The Saint of Duty's death went from option to necessity, the day you realized his true power. Your narrow foyer was a necromancer's dream, easy to ward, and to ward thoroughly. You had washed the whole little vestibule with a gossamer-thin layer of regrowing ash, and pressed bone of each type into holes in the walls. On breach, anyone passing through would have their arms ripped from their sockets and their legs whirlpooled down into deep bogs of boiling hot bone that crept up their bodies like incendiary gel. To follow up, they would be run through with 4,987 sharpened, flexible needles of your own temporal bone. Unbreakable, reactive, instant. Only an idiot would have stopped there. Your quarters had windows. If you had wanted to invade anyone's space, you would have put on a haz. You knew a real lictor didn't even need that. Crawled over the outside of the habitation ring and found the inevitable gap in the room's armour. There were no such gaps in your quarters. You had studied the floor plan and spent hours perched atop a ladder of skeletons, sliding hot gobbets of your blood and spit into the crawl spaces above the wall panels. You had stood at the docking bay and opened the airlock on a sack of bones and walked back inside with them pattering parallel over the outside hull as you guided them to your windows and warded the plex with them. You had sent them down the plug holes in your pump sink and in the shining white edifice of the tub. You got the beginnings of a tension headache merely from the ward's reaction to Ianthe Tridentarius visiting your bedroom. If she had noticed the fine bone dust you'd blown all over her clothes, a glitter of thanagy on all her robes, she had not said a word, which made you suspect that she knew and was doing worse to you in secret. You'd found none of her traps, and it made you jittery. Naturally, none of your spaces could be considered safe. You slept with your sword in your arms. You often woke yourself up suddenly to practice how quickly you could throw yourself into action. Without a properly ingested cavalier, you had only yourself to rely on. You had to work 9 times harder. But you thought you at least knew your vulnerabilities. You were 18 years old now, and a lictor of the first house. But in some secret chamber of your heart, you clung grimly to the ways of the ninth. Despite Dead Harrow's insistence that you become a generalist, you were on first instinct a bone magician. Your wards were bone wards, to some extent, blood wards. It was not that you did not account for spirit magicians. You had reasonably warded for everything, for every scenario, both certain and uncertain. But your magic was at its heart still the magic of a ninth house necromancer. This was your downfall. You were in the bath when it happened. The Mithraeum's quaint bathrooms had no sonic appliances. You could only bathe in water, which you had grown to accept. Ianthe openly enjoyed it and kept saying you weren't running it hot enough. But you did not quite believe that hot water wasn't injurious. You bathed in a few centimetres of water somewhat below blood temperature, wrapped in your exoskeleton and behind your multiplicity of bone wards, and for some benighted reason, you considered yourself safe. The central ward in your bathroom was near the light fixture, where the protruding light made the ceiling tiles fragile and non-contiguous. You did not notice anything amiss until you saw fine grey grains in your bathwater, until you cupped this water in your palm, thinking it was soap, or that you were unusually dirty. Even when you saw the soft trickle of dying, pulverized bone drifting down from your ceiling ward, you still did not fully comprehend. The milled bone lay in your hands, unresponsive and inert. Only when you tried to join it together did you realize it was dead, in the way only the oldest bones in the most historical part of the monument of Dreaber were dead. The bones whose remnant thanagy had trickled out of them over nearly 10,000 years, like water from a pinhole in a bucket, leaving behind calcium dust too far gone to answer a necromancer. If the bones interred in the Mithraeum had been subject to time's full ravages, not stalled by the gentle touch of the Prince Undying, only their most ancient stratum would have resembled the specks in your hands. It took perhaps 5 seconds from speck to trickle to realization. Your wards had been destroyed. And then you heard a crash from the foyer, and then your bathroom door exploded open. Your immediate reaction was to cocoon yourself in a thick shell of tendon-fused bone. This would have been a good trick if it had worked. Nothing responded. Your exoskeleton slid off your body as though embarrassed by you. The bone studs in your ears were numb. The bone chips you kept tucked in niches throughout the bathroom did not twitch as you pulled on them. Every bone in reach was dormant and immobile. You were far more naked than if you had simply taken off all your clothes, which you had, in fact, also done. And the Saint of Duty stood in the doorway with his spear and his sword and his tender green eyes in his hard concrete face as though your wards were nothing. He drew back his arm and hurled his spear at your heart. You flung yourself so violently to the right that the entire tub swayed and tipped onto its side with an enormous porcelain crack and a rush of tepid water that sluiced across the tiles to lap against the toes of his boots. The sword you had balanced across the bath, its bones scabbard, flaking away in chunks like the candied coating from a sweet, clattered onto the floor. You grabbed for it, but he stepped forward and kicked it away. You were grovelling in half a centimetre of soapy water and gritty skeletal residue at the feet of your assassin. The spear he had thrown and the sword you could barely use were out of your reach. Your layers of traps and contingency plans had been rendered abruptly useless. You were soaking wet, and you were naked. It was probably desperation that saved your life. You had trained your whole necromantic career to move for space, to fight from a distance. The Lictor must have anticipated that. He had seen you do it before. He did not anticipate you throwing yourself at him with the only biddable bone you had left, which was your own. Great spurs burst through the heels of your hands from your carpal bones, and you slashed wildly at his chest, at his face, at the arm holding the crimson-ribboned rapier. You had extended your curved, bloodied talons of trapezoid and capitate into him, through the fabric of his shabby shirt, into the meat of his pectoral muscles, before he bounced your head back against the door jamb. The back of your skull smashed into the steel casing, but he was falling back, and he was taking you with him. As Ortus staggered over the threshold into the bedroom, you had a split second's perception of your broken wards lying in heaps and desiccated clumps by the door, your regenerating ash all dried up on the threshold like so many ancient clags. He dropped his sword to wrench your claws out of his chest, and you understood what he had done. He took your bloody spurs between his fingers, and the blood fell away into powder as he stripped away the thanagy. He did not absorb it or try to turn it back on you. He simply undid it with the dismissive ease of upending a jug of water over a drain. The spikes of living bone, freshly grown from your own body, faded in seconds into brittle twigs. They snapped off in his hands and he tossed them aside. You were dazed. You were horrified. The sword was in his hand again, vaulted neatly back into his grip by the blood streaming down his arm. He was too close to bring the blade to bear, so he simply swung the butt hard into the side of your face. Your cheeks staved in. You felt your jaw splinter and a couple of teeth tumbled loose in your mouth like ragged little dice. You staggered away with the force of the blow, He stepped clear and sliced inward and down, opening you somewhere under the ribs, and you spat in his face. The blood sprayed feebly from your lips and spattered to the floor. The teeth, on the other hand, hung in the air for a moment, blossoming into perfect four-pronged flowers of sharp enamel, each one angled toward a verdant eye. You shot those teeth forward like bullets. They flew as you fell sideways, your balance lost. You could feel the depression fracture at the back of your skull. You could feel your brachial arteries spraying, panicked. Your collapse against the wall meant you did not see what happened next. Neither, however, did he. There was an unpleasant, wet sound as tooth met eye. Ortis did not cry out in pain. You might have respected that, once. He merely turned away, his sword in his hand and the spear dragging behind him, and exploded back out through your ravished front door, your untidy, ward-strewn foyer. You were left slick with bathwater, wet with blood, half dead and dismayed on the floor outside your bathroom. The injuries could be seen to. Arteries could be stanched, then snapped back together. Meat could be sewn up and skin made whole. Dentine was easily reconstructed, and so was enamel, though you might have to reform your jaw a few times before your bite was correct. Nothing cracked in your skull had driven itself into your brain, and the bleeding could be corrected. But your peace was gone forever. The saint of duty could bypass your wards at any time. The saint of duty was a thanagy void. The saint of duty was the ultimate nemesis of a bone adept. You would never be able to sleep again. It was at this point that someone, obviously drawn by the noise from down the corridor, tiptoed over the mess at your front door and peered inside. You did not have to feel her presence to know it was her. You knew the sound of her shoes. "Harrow," Ianthe ventured, from somewhere near the door. Then she obviously stopped and saw you naked, bloodied, flayed in your own anguish, with soapsuds still on your feet. You hallucinated that you could smell her. Sweat, musk, vetiver. You saw your probable future clearly. You had not until that point understood the danger. If Ianthe Tridentarius knelt beside you then, no matter with what sugary contempt or filigreed third condescension, you would press your diminished bloody terror into her. You would creep naked into her lap shamelessly and weep. You would crawl like a worm to whatever clinging scrap of solace she would give you. All your slithering, degraded desperation for condolence you would give to your sister Lictor with a brazen thirst that you would never come back from. She would be your end, as surely as the hammer to the oxygen sealant machine of your childhood. You would have reached for her with the mindless desire of an infectious disease. You would have whored yourself to her as necrosis to a wound. So maybe it was for the best that after a pregnant pause, the Princess of Ida said, "Wow, not how I imagined this happening at all." And you heard her hasty footsteps retreat, away, back down the corridor whence she came. Then she was gone. You lay prone on the cool black tiles, staring up at the smears on the ceiling where your wards had been, dazed and despairing, nearly too dead to sew yourself back up. In the back of your head you heard the secondarius bell pealing. Pealing. Extent beyond any ninth sacred composition, and never called by any tomb-ringer. Aloud, you said through swollen lips, "The saint of duty must die." And on the bed, the body said, "Yes." Chapter 25. Your lethal oath was not reflected in any more general solemnity in the Mithraeum. Despite the apocalypse you had suffered, not much seemed to change. Everyone was far too busy to care. The next time you sat down to talk to Teacher, your heart in your throat and your tea stubbornly undrunk, he did not even mention it. Surely he knew. Surely he must have known everything. You were too prideful to beg salvation, but too stupid not to blurt as a diversion from your own panic.
Lord, I saw the Saint of Duty kissing the body of Kithareya the First.
Part of his biscuit dropped off in his tea. He looked at it with genuine consternation, then at you with equally genuine consternation, then back at the biscuit.
Harrowhark, I hate to ask, but are you certain?
Even God distrusted you.
Teacher, I swear by the locked tomb.
I wouldn't swear by that in this instance, he murmured, and took his dented teaspoon to fish out a quivering and deliquescent glob of ginger biscuit. Then he looked at you. There were sleep marks beneath his eyes. He was not wearing his halo of infant phalanxes and pearl-coloured leaves, and his hair looked only hastily brushed. He ran one hand through it, as though conscious of your critical gaze.
Well, he said eventually, that's unfortunate.
Is it not a sin?
You knew you sounded like a quisling. You knew you sounded like a prattling gossipmonger.
What you really wanted to say was, Lord, I was in my bathtub, and he drank my wards dry of thanergy, and I burst his eyeballs before he could destroy me. I have not slept in 48 hours. I asked Mercy Morn how best to stimulate my own cortisol to keep me awake. Lord, she did, and I fear I have done something to my hypothalamus. Don't you think it's strange?
Only in that the closest thing to interest Ortus ever showed in anybody was in Pyrrha, and in the criminals he hunted, said the Emperor of the Nine Houses. When he kicked that Edenite commander out an airlock, it was like seeing a man on his wedding day. Not exactly romance, though. Harrow, over 10,000 years I've known that man, and he is legendarily unamorous. I have watched 6 other lictors carry out a myriad's worth of inadvisable love affairs with one another, because it is a very long time to be alone. But never him. He was unassailable. I won't believe he's doing anything to Kithareya. Everyone liked her. He liked her. But there's a huge leap between liking and corpse compulsion.
You stared, feeling mildly drunk and unutterably pitiful at your repeatedly uneaten biscuit. Teacher said quietly, "You must think us all a depraved set of immortal criminals." You said nothing. He pressed,
"Harrow, do something normal. Learn how to make a meal. Read a book. Go ahead and prepare. Our lives revolve around us all preparing. But take the time to rest. Have you slept lately?"
It was the first time you realized God could not understand you. And nobody cared. And nobody paid you the slightest bit of attention, including the Saint of Duty, who was as whole and as normal and as two-eyed as ever. You had not held out much hope that you had done anything permanent. The only surety that it had even happened was the lasting smell of damp on your carpets. So you went to Ianthe, and you asked her how to make soup.
"Oh, it's easy," said the Princess of Ida breezily.
Despite Augustine's increasing critiques, she showed no signs of temper, as might have been anticipated. In fact, she seemed to get more carefree with every failure.
"You cut up an onion, burn it at the bottom of the pot, put in a few vegetables, and then some meat.
It won't taste like anything, so put in a few teaspoons of salt, and then it'll taste like a few teaspoons of salt. In obedience to the Emperor, you made soup. You had never seen anybody cook before. You did not like it. There were technical manuals on the subject in a kitchen drawer, and you pored over those, rather than attempting Ianthe's heir on the theme of salt. By the evening of the third day after your interrupted bath, you had not slept for 86 hours, but you had read a book, and you had made soup 3 times. During sleeping hours, you lay beneath your bed in the dark, hardly breathing, staring up at the dustless ribs of the steel mattress slats. You prayed to the corpse of the locked tomb, or you said to yourself, "Oh God, oh God, oh God," until it slurred together on your tongue and joined the orchestra of whispers that thrummed between your ears, waiting for the assault that did not come. It was also on the third day, post-Autus, that the tension in the Mithraeum gained weight and sharpness, like salt water forming crystals. This had nothing to do with you. It was the countdown that Augustine had issued to Ianthe. 5 more days, he had said to her. You knew, because he had said it over breakfast, right in front of you and Mercy. You've 5 days left, my chick. If you don't start using that sword arm properly by then, I shan't bother to teach you a damn thing more. I'm not interested in charity cases. If I were, I'd be teaching Harrow. In another lifetime, you might have been icily furious, or at the very least, chagrined. In this one, you were simply looking at your knife and your fork and your spoon, and trying to remember which did what. The spoon, with its concave pit, was probably for transferring liquids. In its back, you caught sight of Ianthe, who had put her colourless chin in her hand and was leaning her head into it, as though listening without much interest to a bedtime story. "As you will it, brother." Everyone was snappish and cross, except Ianthe, and except you. You drifted through the Mithraeum with your great sword on your back, and your hand never far from the end, pommel of your rapier. And you made soup. 2 days after Augustine's ultimatum, perhaps impressed with your newfound understanding of soup, or hungry for social cohesion, a frazzled god asked you to make everyone dinner. You opened more of the recipe books. You spent some time cleaning out your weights and measures and picking through the warehouse-sized supply rooms for the most appropriate ingredients. And for a long time, you locked yourself in the bathroom to do what you had to do. 126 hours. You no longer felt pain. Sometimes your jaw rattled to itself, but it was almost musical. That night you made soup more carefully than ever. The recipe said it had to cook for a long time. You paced up and down the kitchen, distracted and startled by lights as the air grew steamy and a little sweet-smelling. When the alarm sounded to say it was done, you nearly screamed. It took you a while to turn it off. You tested the result of your labour, after a moment's hesitation. You still hated strong flavours, and it took you a while to understand tastes. The soup did not taste like anything very specific, but you did not add Ianthe's teaspoons of salt. You transferred it to a big tureen, and when you all sat down around the table, the Emperor served everyone, like he always did. On those first few days in the Mithraeum, you had been terrified by the idea of the god of the 9 houses serving you food, but it was just his way. He was pleased with you. He smiled that rueful, dented smile, and he rested his hand on your shoulder very lightly when he filled your bowl. "As I said, Harrowhark," he said, "make a meal. Read a book. It's the little things." There were 2 days left before Ianthe's deadline,
and all the lictors ate with a distinct lack of relish. You watched Ianthe take a spoonful of food as you struggled with your cutlery. Your soup did not look like a bad effort, and you had been vaguely proud of it. The thick, translucent gold-whiteness of the pot liquor, the unburnt onion floating in white, stratified wedges, the candy orange of the stored carrots. You had read up on vegetables carefully, trying to overcome your aversion to their colours. You had not wanted anything that might dissolve entirely in the soup over the length of cooking called for. Needs salt, was Ianthe's judgment. Too much water, but not a bad effort, said Augustine, with forced jollity. Broth needs to thicken over time, Harrow. You had let it thicken for hours, then added a great deal of water in a panic. Do not get me wrong, sis. Eating a new cook's food after 10,000 years is frankly exciting. Let me give you a list of my favourite meals, so that you can get them interestingly wrong. The saint of duty ate your soup at a stolid, uninterested, mechanical pace. You had noticed at previous dinners that he did not like some particular vegetables, so you had put them all in. Deprived of solid choices, he was mostly drinking stock. God had taken a spoonful, eaten it, then put